What is amateur radio? As an amateur radio ham operator, you talk by two-way radio to other hams. Anyone can be a ham, no matter what age, sex, or physical ability. Ham radio doesn't have to cost much. Your radio station can be held in your hand or take up a corner in your bedroom. You even get your choice of ways to communicate: voice, Morse code, or by computer. You and your friends can make new friends across town and around the world. Hams use microphones, telegraph keys, or computer keyboards as their key to open the door to talk to the world. Getting started is easy. All you need to do is spend time with a beginner study guide. ARRL produces guides that contain all you need to pass the entry-level license tests. The book is available on audio tape. The license is pretty easy to study for and earn. And once you do, you have a special identity, plus a call sign that says, "I'm an amateur radio operator." For more information, call 860-594-0396. 860-594-0396. The world of amateur radio is waiting. Reach out.
Hi, everyone. This is Atrevida, and you are listening to Conversations on a Tightrope's Ham Radio Show. The first clip you just heard, with all the static, was the first voice transmission by Fessenden in 1900. And the second clip was an intro found on the American Radio Relay League's webpage, www.arrl.org. I have been digging up all kinds of info on ham radio on what I have penned, Google University, and I cannot emphasize how amazed and interesting and exciting this hobby has become for me. Talking to astronauts, meeting people all over the world, saving lives, and who knows what else we will all learn this evening with the help of my two guests who can answer most, if not all, of the mysteries surrounding ham radio. But first, just imagine. A housewife in North Carolina makes friends over the radio with another ham in Lithuania. An Ohio teenager uses his computer to upload a digital chess move to an orbiting space satellite where it's retrieved by a fellow chess enthusiast in Japan. An aircraft engineer in Florida participating in a DX contest swaps his call sign and talks to hams in 100 different countries during a single weekend. In California, volunteers save lives as part of their involvement in an emergency response. And from his room in Chicago, a ham's pocket-sized handheld radio allows him to talk to friends in the Carolinas. This unique mix of fun, public service, and convenience is the distinguishing characteristic of amateur radio. Although hams get involved for many reasons, they all have in common a basic knowledge of radio technology and operating principles, and pass an examination for the FCC license to operate on radio frequencies known as the amateur bands. Now, why do you need a license? Although the main purpose of the hobby is fun, it is called the amateur radio service because it also has a serious face. The FCC created that service to fill the need for a pool of experts who could provide backup emergency communications in times of need. In addition, the FCC acknowledged the ability of the hobby to advance communication and technical knowledge and enhance international goodwill. So now it's time for me to introduce my two guests. I have here with me Kenneth Getz, G-O-E-T-Z, from Cairo, New York. He is the State Races, R-A-C-E-S, Radio Officer, which is the Radio Amateur Civil Emergency Service, and he is a member of the Rip Van Winkle Amateur Radio Society. And I also have Wayne F. Gearing from Canaan, New York, who is a member of the Rip Van Winkle Amateur Radio Society and a fire instructor at New York State OFPC. He studied educational communications at University of Albany and is a retired science teacher. So these are my questions before I turn all of this over to you. I would like both of you to give the WGXC listeners out there just a brief bio of yourselves. So, Kenneth, can you start?
Sure, no problem at all. First, it's a pleasure to be here with all of you this evening. My original interest in radio goes back to, as many people would quote, Marconi was a child, I believe. I was about 12 years old or so when, for one Christmas, my parents gave me a shortwave receiver. And I started off where my morning news used to come from Radio Australia. My evening news was the BBC and Deutsche Welle in Germany. And in between all of these international broadcasts and international broadcast stations, I find these strange goings-on with two people talking to each other. And I started learning that, hey, this is ham radio. This sounds pretty interesting. And there were people from all over the world. It piqued an interest in amateur radio in that matter for me. Well, I started studying for my ham radio license. I was in school at the time yet. And toward the end of the one summer, other things came along and other interests, and it sort of got shelved. Many years later, married, living up here in Greene County, my wife and I were doing our weekly food shopping, and I see a magazine on the stands in one of the food stores. Amateur radio licensing, no code needed. Wow, no code anymore? That was always one of the big stumbling blocks. I picked up the magazine, it was on a Wednesday, and I found out that next evening, on Thursday evening, there was an amateur radio exam session going on up at RPI up in Detroit. Went down to the local radio shack, picked up a book on how to become a ham radio operator. And lo and behold, Thursday evening, I passed my first radio exam test.
That's wonderful. You have some wonderful equipment also.
Yeah, it's gotten a little more involved over the years.
Yes, I could see.
It started out very simple. I received a gift from my wife that Christmas of my first radio. And I went on very happily with a no-code exam for about the first 5 years. I got into doing satellite communications and was fortunate enough to speak to a couple of the astronauts on space shuttle missions and things of that type. And then around 97 or so, I got the bug to upgrade and start doing all this international stuff. And for about a month and a half period, I drove my family absolutely insane. Every place they went, in the car, at home, at work, they heard Morse code. Because at that time, you needed code to go to the higher level licenses. And I went on further and eventually went to the general class license and went from there. It also led to what my career currently is. I work for the State Department of Homeland Security. Currently, it's at the Office of Interoperable and Emergency Communications. One of the requirements is to have an amateur radio license. You can't work there without it.
That's fantastic, yes. So, go on.
Okay. And really, it's an integral part of what we do on the emergency service point of view. The RACES organization, the Radio Amateur Civil Emergency Service, is a backup form of communications for not only within the state, but down to many county and town levels. And like the ARRO has on their website, amateur radio, when all else fails, it's there when you need it. It's a backup form of communication that everybody can use.
Yes, I was amazed when I found that on the internet. They had a clip on Katrina. That's probably what was being used, I would think, when they were trying to get help.
Oh, most definitely. Mm-hmm. I can go back as far as, well, it didn't get here very heavy, but the North Country of New York State in 1998 was inundated with a massive ice storm. Hundreds of thousands of people without power, utility poles were snapped, it was quite a mess. And because of the lack of communications, the lack of cell sites, and much of the public service infrastructure even being out, we were heavily relying on amateur radio getting messages through for sheltering people, getting food supplies brought in and out. It was a massive operation and amateur radio worked.
Well, I would like to now ask Wayne Gearing if you could pitch in and give me a bio, a little bit of yourself and how you really got into this?
Well, it's tough to describe exactly where something like this begins, but in a similar way to Ken, growing up on the dairy farm from Canaan, TV wasn't around for my early years, so there was a lot of radio listening. As Ken said, you discover the other bands on the radio that were more than just broadcast. And I guess the genes were always there as far as being a technical person was concerned. So the presents I was looking for at a young age were, you know, the science kits and electricity kits and so on. So it just kind of evolved from there. I was first licensed at 12 years old in 1960. At the time, it was Channel 10, and I forget which network was sponsoring that local channel then, but they offered a ham radio class on the air. You had to get up at 6 o'clock in the morning. And for an hour, they'd give you the theory instructions from code practice on TV. And then we went to one of the local, there used to be some ham radio dealers in the Albany area. We went to one of the local, it was called Fort Orange Radio. The FCC actually gave you the test then. And now Ken and I belong to local teams of volunteers that give the test. But then you had to take the test from the FCC engineer. So the FCC came to Albany. There was about 100 of us in the room, took the test. And I got my first license then. So. And, you know, just all through school, being part of what they would now call the geek squad, you know, just with the PA systems and the projectors and the lighting system for the theater productions and so on, just with the technical background. And again, the Morse code kept a lot of us from getting the advanced licenses then. So in a way, the elimination of the code now has been pretty good. But took it with me to college, got me a job at college. There was a broadcast station at college. The head engineer at the radio station was also a ham radio operator. They do kind of the job exploring thing when you're a freshman, and I took an interest in the radio station. As soon as they found out I was a ham radio operator, boom, I'm into the radio station at the college. So that could have gone, you know, in a career path that way, as well. As Ken said, it very often led to career paths. College, marriage, a career, teaching science and chemistry for 32 years. Ham radio got pushed a little bit to the side for a while. Let my license expire. Got back into it again about 1990 when I saw, again, as Ken said, I saw a class advertised was being given at Ichabod Crane School at the time. I was teaching at Taconic Hills at the time. So got my license back, and somehow at the age of 45, I beat that code barrier that had hit me all the time as a teenager. I couldn't pass the code. At the age of 45, I finally passed the code test to get the highest class license. And it's been a good ride ever since. The past two or three years, there's an organization called, it's got a really nice acronym, it's called MARS, which stands for Military Auxiliary Radio System, and basically it's a group of ham radio operators around the country, either former military, that's not a requirement, but a lot of them are former military, but again, this is a subset of the military communications provided by amateur radio operators, so in case the main channels of communications for the military break down, we're there again in support mode, similar to what Ken was describing for public safety.
Well, what I found very interesting was that, according to ARRL and the FCC, it you can pretty much, not too expensively, get involved in it with just walkie-talkies.
Well, oh yeah, Wayne has them with him this evening.
The radio I have right here is 20 years old, still works fine, but you can pick this up at an amateur radio flea market for about $50, and you're on the air with one of the most popular amateur radio bands today.
But you could pick it up, but can you buy it without a license?
You can. Well,
you can't use it.
You can.
You can buy it
legally. Yeah. Anybody. Yes. Anybody
you could
buy
listen,
it.
But you can't. How do they do that? If you, like, I would buy that now. Oh, how much trouble will I get into if I?
If you transmit, it's not like the FCC is just hanging around right. waiting for
well,
someone to make
I have Homeland Security
yeah, transmissions.
So
yeah. The one of the nice things about amateur radio is it's basically self-policing.
Yes.
So we don't depend on. I mean, you know, the FCC is always there if there is some major problem with someone abusing the privilege, but basically it's a self-policing. So if someone hears someone on the air that doesn't belong there, we also have direction finding and tracking equipment so that we can narrow it. If the person persists by not staying off the air, we politely ask them that, you know, if you have a license, please give us your call sign. If you're not licensed, then you need to realize that it's against the FCC rules and regulations for you to be transmitted.
And they could be picked up.
And yes. Yeah. And if that doesn't work, then, as I say, there was an incident a few years ago here right in the Hudson area where we had to track someone down and actually had to get involved in enforcement. But that's very rare. That's very rare.
Overall, it's a very good community. And in general, if somebody just goes on the air without a license, first of all, without giving a call sign, nobody's going to talk to them. And by ignoring the person, most of the times they just go away. Now, if the FCC did get involved, the fines can be tremendous, including jail terms. $10,000 and $15,000 fines, not uncommon. Jail terms can ensue with it. But that's extremely rare. It's a good community. Like Wayne said, it's a self-policing community. There are very, very few problems.
So it's a respected community, and you want to keep it that way.
Yes.
And they want to keep it that way.
Very much so.
And the fact that it's used for emergencies, I think, is wonderful. I mean, I myself am thinking, wow, maybe I can buy a walkie-talkie and actually try this kind of thing. I wanted you to explain the fact that the FCC emphasizes that it is just a two-way communication.
Yeah, the idea is that you're getting a license to carry on communications with other licensed operators in the amateur radio service. It's not like, we're here tonight, we're broadcasting out to the general public. There's a couple of exceptions. The national organization, the ARL that you mentioned, does broadcast bulletins and code practice, even though there's no code requirements. A lot of us still like to use the code, and it's some people call that the original digital mode of communication because the signal's either on or off, like ones and zeros in digital communications. So that's an exception. They can broadcast out certain times of the day, certain times of the year for that purpose only.
And the shuttle launches.
And the shuttle launches, right.
They're allowed
to rebroadcast.
They could rebroadcast all of the communications from the shuttle down to mission control over amateur frequencies for the population of here.
Oh, I was amazed when I went on YouTube and I was listening to the astronauts
yes.
talking to someone.
Yes.
Because they say that even with you didn't call it a novice.
A
technician class.
Yes.
They open up a few times a year, they open up frequencies so that you can even travel, you can go further.
Well,
that's what the FCC.
What happens with the with the space shuttle missions in particular, they have a requirement that all astronauts hold an amateur radio license. And generally in their off times, they would broadcast, I shouldn't say the word broadcast, they would transmit to other amateur radio operators. I was lucky enough to have two separate conversations with shuttles aboard, with astronauts about various shuttle flights.
You have D-Expeditions, is it?
Yes.
Yeah, which DX is like most technical hobbies or technical professions, there's this little bit of lingo that goes with it. DX stands for long distance transmissions and communications. And the idea of a de-expedition is that amateur radio operators, we talked about the simple way of getting into the hobby. You can also spend as much money on amateur one radio that you could buy a good used Mercedes-Benz for. So
yes,
it's
easily.
it's you can take it as far as you want. But most technical hobbies are that way. I mean, the people with computers can do the same thing. And what a lot of these people will do is they will combine their two hobbies, a love for travel and amateur radio. So they'll pack up their gear, and I'm talking the expensive gear now. They pack up close to $100,000 worth of radio equipment.
Oh.
buy a ticket or lease a boat to take them to some obscure place like Peter Island, for example, down near Antarctica.
Right.
Set up a radio station and try to contact as many other amateur radio operators as they can from that location, just to just for the excitement of the contest. But what it also does is it also gives the scientific community an opportunity to test out what's called radio propagation, the way that radio waves travel around the Earth and through the troposphere and the ionosphere. So by going to some of these bizarre places that don't have radio transmissions on a regular basis, it also gives an opportunity to study how the radio waves will propagate in and out of that particular part of the world.
And along that line, like Verse Wayne said about the lingo, dealing with 1D expedition that's happening right now, you could hear me turn around and talk to somebody like Wayne, hey, did you catch the ST0 on 20 working 195 up? And it's like, I say, what? And what that means, the ST0, it happens to be that in the last 2 weeks, the country of Southern Sudan was just created by United Nations decree due to a number of political issues happening there. So Southern Sudan became a brand new country for everybody in amateur radio to be able to try to contact. They received a call sign of ST0 something, in this case ST0R, Sierra Tango Zero Romeo. So everybody's trying to contact them. The rest of the logo that I gave, well, did I catch them on 20 from 195 working up? That happens to be a particular frequency they were on within a certain band, and meaning that they were listening to you to call them on a little bit higher frequency. It's its own lingo that happens in there. And I guess, like Wayne said, most technical aspects tend to get their own language after a while. But there's a group right now, predominantly Italian group, that went to Southern Sudan the second day after the country was created as a new entity. They had it on the air.
I'm going to take a minute. I want to just play a brief 2 minute clip that I got from someone you're familiar with, which is the Finland.
Ah, okay.
CQ, CQ, CQ. Hello, CQ.
Lights are clear.
CQ. You wake up every morning to go to work, then home again. That old routine. Turn on your TV. All of us are not sure a single thing.
This is
the
watching mom doing.
It
really is fascinating.
Checking out the internet, smartphone no more. It's all just badges, friends. You're looking for adventure. Well, you could become a ham. Come join us on the airwaves. Surf the skies and find new friends. Let the world unfold before you.
Hi, Wayne Gary.
You'll be the one who sets the trend.
Cause
you're not like those poor old ways.
Are you a licensed amateur operator? What?
Change your life and start anew. Come and join us on the airwaves. You'll feel free and you'll be happy too. Friends and folks in far-off lands in which you've never even heard. Pick up local knowledge about all world events that just occurred. Turn your hand to contact.
20 seconds.
The dreams start crossing through your veins. You could be the winner. The finest of champagne.
Okay, now that was a clip I found on YouTube, and I was telling you about it, Ken, and you said you contacted them, right?
Yeah, the fellow who was doing that is very big in the contest community. Uh-huh. And even seeing the pictures on YouTube, they have some massive towers and antennas, things that not many hams can really have the luxury of having like what they have. And being a contester myself, I've worked there with people in many of the contests that have happened.
Yes, I recommend WGXC listeners, you go on YouTube and you check out the ham radio clips, because they have some great videos.
Yes.
That you can see how a lot of this is done.
There's and even one local ham. If you do a search for W2RE, it's a local fellow who's in the process of building an unbelievable station up in Summit, New York. And he has quite a few videos showing the station that he's putting up. There are currently three of Plan 6 towers that have already been constructed.
Oh, I have to
say. There's quite a bit on his station.
I'm going to be doing a lot of Googling on YouTube.
Sure.
On ham radio some more. But, Wayne, talk more about how you worked ham radio into when you were teaching your science classes, and how did the children respond to it? Was this high school or elementary?
This was high school at DeKalb Kells, 9 through 12. The nice thing about the hobby is that the technical aspects jump right out at you. So, you know, science and math to deal with the radio transmissions and so on and so forth. But within that hobby, and we've kind of touched upon it here, it's an excellent way to learn geography. Mm-hmm. If you're going to get on the air and you're going to hear somebody with an R0 crawl sign, and you realize that they're coming from someplace in Russia, and you hear another call sign like Stan was saying, right, where's that call sign coming from? Located on the map. So it's an excellent way to teach geography. It's also an excellent way to teach communication skills, because teenagers love to talk a lot, but you put them in front of a microphone like this, and all of a sudden it's like, they just shut down. So it was brought into the class originally by a little coercion. In my ninth grade science class, I introduced them to the hobby, and I had some radios set up at school with the school's permission. We put up some antennas, had some radios in there. And also with the principal's permission that one year, if they got their amateur radio license by the end of the school year, they were exempt from my final exam. So it was kind of a little bit of coercion to get them in. There was only three people that took advantage of it that year, I remember. But once you get two or three of them with their foot in the door, and the other people in the school see the interest that they're generating, it kind of becomes self-sustaining.
I think it's a great activity to encourage math and science.
Mm-hmm.
It, like you say, it's fun, and
yes.
It teaches geography, and
it can open up a wealth of career opportunities as well. And you know, we talked about a lot of people going from interest in amateur radio into certain technical careers. There's also a lot of people out there that were in the technical careers and came into ham radio kind of a back door, what I call the back doorway. They had the technical career first, then they got interested in amateur radio. But the career opportunities that can open things up, there's also a lot of scholarships available for the National Amateur Radio Organizations to sponsor scholarships.
Yes.
Oh, I didn't know that.
For active,
really
one of the active members of our club, Alex, whose call sign is KC2RDK, currently going to SUNY Utica in the technology program. About half of his tuition for this next year coming up is coming from scholarships provided by the amateur radio organizations.
Even some of the local folks
to.
Have done
yes.
that. Yeah.
Oh, but I think the time has come. I mean, it's around 100 years old. About give or take a few years.
Yeah, the hobby itself has been around just about as long as the technology of radio itself. Yes.
Uh-huh. And I think it's. That's why I love WGXC. I think it's time for people to learn to listen again. And you really can't when you watch TV.
Right.
You learn to listen by listening to radio, and then having a hobby such as the ham radio is another way to promote listening skills. So I think it's so great. What are we doing? How are we going to get it to continue, because
the the best way to do it is to get somebody on the faculty, obviously, that has an amateur radio license, or a faculty member who would be interested enough to work with the students and get his or her amateur radio license along with the students. And that's happening all the time around the country. Right now, in this particular area, I'm not aware of any of that kind of activity, but around the country, it's happening all the time.
Well, if someone in the school, if they don't, let's say the school doesn't have anyone with a ham radio license, what if there was an effort to find volunteers who would say, hey, I will come in at a certain time that I have available and we can start this program, I have a license?
It's good. We've looked at that in CARA for a little while. But it's difficult to do something like that where it's after school hours. And to find somebody to commit to that kind of a time frame can be a problem. It's a great program, and the ARRL has a lot of supportive material for it. But ideally, I at least feel it should be a faculty member.
I'm talking to one retired teacher that doesn't have to worry about that may have the time during the day.
But he's busier now than before he retired.
Do you think, ham radio people that...
It's, well, in many ways, it is a graying hobby. It is an older population overall that's involved in ham radio. But what I've at least seen by nature, the people that are in ham radio also tend to be into a lot of other things. And time isn't quite as free as people would like, even in a retired community. The amateur radio population in general tends to be a pretty active group.
Well, if it's a graying hobby, then that means all the more reason why we have to find a way to get the younger people into it, because it's...
Definitely.
Well, it's the same with a lot of other things, too, and the way the demographics of not just this local area, but the country as a whole, where we're moving away from things that used to be popular activities for kids, like scouting, for example, 4-H clubs and things like that. That's all what I call part of the changing culture that we have. The good news is that in many areas you can see a lot of it coming back, because as you look through, and I gave you one copy of the QSD magazine there, as you look around for some of the activity, you'll see that there's actually a youth editor that provides comments to that magazine about activities going on at high schools and colleges. A lot of colleges have amateur radio clubs as part of either one of their departments or as a separate student activity within the student organization. So I think it's starting. I think we're starting to circle around again a little bit. My fire department just had a request to have the Girl Scouts meet there, because the little meeting room they've had, they've got so many new members now that they need a bigger venue to have their meeting. So I think there's some good news about the cultural shift, and I'm hoping that the amateur radio can continue to be part of that cultural shift. We're going to get back into the volunteerism, for example, just some of the activities you're doing here with this radio station is a good example.
I think when I want to just play this clip on Katrina, because when I saw this, I said, wow, I really didn't realize how important ham radio really is, all the more reason. So let's just play this.
Communication was gone. Cell phones died. Nothing worked.
Without the ham radios, we were not able to communicate with our shelters because the phone lines were down. We weren't able to communicate with our other resources like FEMA and NEMA and the Office of Emergency Management. There was no communication whatsoever with all the systems down. It was very important to Dr. O'Brien. Communications are extremely fragile, and this tends to be our biggest issue.
As soon as the wind died down just a little, I was up swinging antennas up on the roof. Immediately began to pass emergency traffic positions. Nurses, any state, bring your life. We need medical supplies, additional vaccines.
HF traffic, emergency traffic, got a lot of it. There were requests for rescue. There were still people trapped in dormitories at some universities in Aurora. I handled a lot of emergency traffic there, and let's face it, this is the greatest natural disaster we've had in the United States. It's really been an experience for me, and I'm glad to hear.
I wound up setting up in a Walmart parking lot. I was receiving traffic over the HF net, a lot of search and rescue, people trapped in attics, people trapped on roofs. There was a woman in labor with serious complications. She was not going to make it if she didn't get out. They couldn't get a helicopter into that hospital. So the helicopter got into the Tulane hospital, and then they had a boat en route to pick her up. And we had her ready to go and getting in the boat. She got out safely and got into the chopper.
I am from New Orleans. This region is a very deep and super important part of who I am. I had to do something. This is my first emergency as a ham radio operator. We put up an antenna at the Red Cross headquarters in Brookhaven, set them up with a radio base, moved down to Gulfport, did some work there, slept in a school. It's better than sitting home and watching on TV. It's very difficult for me because I'm from New Orleans. I went ahead and got my ticket after 9/11 because I wanted to be of some use. I love the idea of talking on the radio to people on the other side of the planet who you've never seen. And so I did it so that I would be of use.
Without the ham operators, we really don't have a way to communicate. And I'd like to say to the ham operators that helped us with this hurricane that they have been a wonderful asset. They've always had a smile on their face. They worked really long, hard hours. And they were there to support us in every way that they could. So I say a heartfelt thank you from the shelter members, from the staff, and also from the Red Cross.
I would like to say that, so that's one really good reason for people to consider learning ham radio, even at the lowest level, the technician level. You have it in your home, you know, that, and well, you take it with you when you can take it when you go camping, right?
Most definitely.
The motto for the service is "When all else fails," and you'll see that logo on some of the patches and so on that we wear, and that was what the Katrina clip says. You know, the cell phones were down, public safety radios were down, and so on. But they were talking about setting up the amateur radio antennas and radio systems in parking lots and so on. That's where the service really shines, and all the other stuff that we do on a day-to-day basis is just practice for being able to do that when we have to. And most of us do have things, and if you see my car and Ken's car outside, you'll see five or six antennas stick up on the top. And, you know, the middle console of the vehicle is usually taken out to make room for the radios and so on.
Passengers? No.
But it the idea is that we are using this on a regular basis so that when all else fails, we are ready to step in and use our equipment to fill the gap.
Well, what a great motivator for young people. You tell them, listen, first of all, I always imagine that they'll probably go through withdrawal. If something was to happen, they couldn't talk on their cell phones. Yeah. So the idea that they would have a ham radio, if something happened with their cell phones or anything, they still would be connected.
And it even goes beyond that, because what most people don't even realize, during any major disasters, one of the first things to become overloaded and unusable is cell sites. So you see a disaster, an example I can even give, we responded from the state on the Binghamton shootings 2 or 3 years ago, and everybody's out there trying to use their cell phones. Now that was a localized event, but the cell sites became totally unusable because they were that jammed.
The issue with the cell phones and the lessons that I used to try to get across with the students I worked with in the amateur radio club, there's talking and then there's communicating. Just because they're talking, it doesn't mean they're communicating. And what we need to do especially in emergency communications, is to make sure that we are being very precise, very succinct, and we're just getting the message across in as few words as possible, because the people that need the information don't have a lot of time to listen to all the extras and the frills going on. So let's not just be talking, let's actually be communicating. And that's one of the lessons that, and again, things that are practiced all the time in the amateur radio community. We have something called NETS, short for a network of stations getting together and practicing relaying information from one to the other to the other to make sure that we are capable of doing that.
In the easiest and the most concise way.
Yes, an example of that, the RACES group, the Radio Amateur Civil Emergency Service.
Which meets in Carroll.
There are groups in various counties, okay. Yes. But we have a statewide net, which takes place every Sunday morning, 9 o'clock local time on Sunday. And we just practice sending some messages back and forth, making sure they're concise, very precisely sent. But taking that to when it was really needed, we're coming up on the 10th anniversary of the September 11th events. When the second aircraft hit the towers on that morning of September 11th, one of the first things that happened was we got word, we're in trouble, get the amateur radio network going. And within about 15 or 20 minutes, a statewide network was in place. There was a liaison to the Virginia Amateur Radio Group, since there were events that happened in Virginia. And there was a liaison in place to the Pennsylvania group for the event that happened on the field in Pennsylvania. We had contact with the Mars Network, as Wayne mentioned. He's a Mars member, as am I. And everything just automatically fell into place based on the practice that goes on the routine day-to-day conversations that we have.
Well, then I think that this is what we should do. We should get both help to hook up the seniors with the young people and get them to all learn ham radio.
The term that's used for an older or more mature amateur radio operator to mentor someone else, we have our own term, it's called an Elmer. And not sure exactly where that came from, just like nobody's really sure where ham came from, but the idea of Elmering younger people, that's going on all the time. And
yes,
this Rip Van Winkle group that we have here is very good at that. We sponsor, at least we try to sponsor, a licensing class every year, either through the auspices of the community college or on our own. And we've been bringing quite a few young people in the past few years to keep them in. That's going to be the issue. But if we can get them involved in some of these other... The good news is we don't get deployed that often for these kind of services. That's good, but it also means that it doesn't help pique the interest because they're not involved in real events that often.
What I'm hearing, though, is that if you learn how to do this when you're young, even if you drop it for a little while because you're busy, somewhere along the line, pick it up.
You keep it.
So it's sort of like riding a bike.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
And
so,
what I think helps right now also with some of the younger people, they see us, we're talking with a mic in front of us, or God forbid, you're sitting there using a Morse code key and sending code. That's 100-year-old technology. But there's a lot of what we do these days that involves a computer as well. You're going station to station using computerized data, and that tends to pique the interest of some of the younger people a little bit faster. There are modes on the high frequency bands, if you will, the short wave frequencies, we go long distance. There are computer modes which are actually more robust and easier to use than voice or even code. And that can help get some of the younger people more into it, because they're so used to using and so familiar with the computer that adapting the computer to the radio can be a very good thing.
Oh, yes.
There's a complete HF radio email network that's functioning around the country right now. That's not only used by the military, but by the amateur radio group. So if again, all else fails, and we can't depend on the phone company's phone lines or satellite connections, the HF radio network can provide. It's not going to give you, you know, graphics and web pages like internet, but it will let you do email.
Well, it also says, though, that they now transmit images.
Oh, yes.
Yes.
Yes, both still and live TV.
And when I went on YouTube, they even have Morse code songs.
Yes.
Yeah.
Which I found very entertaining.
One of my favorite clips is from a Jay Leno show about 2 years ago. He invited two teenagers with for texting.
With Chip Margelli.
And he had two amateur radio operators, and he gave them both the message to send from opposite sides of the stage, the teens texting and the Morse code operators. And, you know, fortunately for us, the Morse code operators beat the kids texting on the phone, getting the message from point A to point B.
I happen to know the one fellow who was actually sending the code. He played the part to the max, right down to the green visor over his head and the armbands holding his sleeves up, and played the part looking like an 1880s telegrapher. But he's quite a character himself.
I thought this, it's just a minute, but I thought this was so cute. The Twilight Zone clip. And you can comment on the comments. It's just a minute. It's an old one.
What's wrong with the TV?
Not just the TV, all the lights in the house are flickering. Did you leave something on in the kitchen, a dishwasher, anything like that?
No, the dishes are all stacked. TV's still off. Might be the aerial wires, Stu. It slipped loose or something once before.
Well, I doubt if that affects all the lights in the house, but it's easy enough to check. Seems all right. Martha, come here a moment. Look, that wasn't there this morning, was it?
No. The Andersons took their antenna with them when they moved.
It's a star of luck.
What?
Ham radio operators, you know what they do to radio and television reception.
Daddy.
Young Ellen?
I don't know what's the matter, but I was listening to my radio while I was studying, and all of a sudden it began picking up these weird voices.
Ham radio operators.
Well, is there anything we can do about it, or we just have to live with it?
Well, there's one thing we can do. We can make sure they've got a license to operate.
Oh, well, do you think you should, Stu? I mean, those men seem so kind of threatening somehow.
I just thought that was so entertaining, and the comment was on that was, let's see how many misconceptions we can find. One, radio signals just won't interfere with the power. Two, radio signals wouldn't interfere with properly shielded coaxial television cable. What does it say? If they haven't properly shielded it, that's their fault, because radio signals are so ubiquitous that they're bound to absorb some other signal instead. And three, ham radio operators don't broadcast on wavelengths that are already in use by ordinary radio stations.
Right.
But
well, in all fairness, back in the day,
Channel 2 and 6 made this.
I had an issue with a neighbor. Yeah, that when all signals were just received over the air, and out my way, we got 6, 10, and 13 on a good day. And some people tried picking up channel 2 out of Utica.
Right.
And one of the frequencies I used to use on a regular basis would interfere. But
right.
the point they're trying to make there, too, was a good one toward the end, you know, making sure that the person is licensed.
Yes.
And we do have a certain obligation. One of the things that the FCC insists that we do in exchange for the privilege of operating is we have to make sure that we are operating all of our radios within the approved technical standards that the FCC establishes. And that includes not interfering with consumer electronics that are properly shielded. If they're not properly shielded, we don't have any control over that.
Yeah, years ago, a lot of the TV sets, in the old days of the tube sets and so on, some of those weren't really the best construction. And at that time also, like Wayne said, it was more over-the-air reception rather than cable reception. And especially Channel 2 sat on almost the same frequency as one of the amateur radio bands. So years back, some of those things could be a bit of an issue.
I noticed when I found the list of people who have licenses in Cairo and Hudson, some also had women who, like, let's say it was Wayne Gearing, and then I would see some woman's name with Gearing. It seems like there are some husband and wife teams that do that. Do you find that a lot, where the mate also gets involved and it becomes...
Not just a mate, I'd say. We all tend to push it toward the whole family.
Yeah, the whole family. We've got where, you know, a husband, wife, and two or three kids. Yeah. One of the local physicians here at CMH, he and his wife and four children, I believe, are all licensed now.
Yeah.
So it can be a family affair, certainly.
My older daughter's been licensed since she's 12. Now she's married and living in Florida. My younger daughter had no interest in it, but I convinced her husband to do it, so my son-in-law is licensed up here now.
So then we can say that ham radio keeps, you know, family together.
It can be a family affair.
Depends on
ham
the attitude,
radio?
Yes. Yeah. It can.
It can do just the opposite in some cases. But
we'll let it go.
Yeah.
It's like any other hobby, though. If the whole family can't buy into it, then there's going to be there could be some issues. But
does your wife Ken? Is she involved? But she seems very understanding.
Oh yeah, she's very supportive of the hobby. There's no doubt. I'm very fortunate in that matter. I mean, I've got a whole room of the house that otherwise could have been an extra bedroom in that house.
Yes, when I walked in there, I thought it was amazing.
Yeah.
My wife's the same way, very supportive. In fact, we arranged our first date via amateur radio. So
really? Now that's a story.
We met at the Chatham Fair, and the radio club at Chatham High School at the time had a radio station set up at the 4-H building in the Chatham Fair. So we had met, and I had gone home and started thinking about the person I had just met. So I sent a message back to the fair from my home station to the station at the fair, telling them to get in touch with her, and we were going to make the date. So our first date was actually arranged during ham radio.
That's good.
And we'll be married 42 years later this month, so it worked out okay.
Or maybe we could have a show on ham radio connections, right? And that's a great idea. Hey, you'll get young people to listen in on that, including seniors, because there's lots of them looking for connections, right?
I guess so.
So I tell you, I really enjoyed this. I'm going to briefly end this so that I can just maybe read a couple of things about my animal connections. And I'm forever grateful for you guys to come here and educate us. I've learned so much, and it would be wonderful if we had a nice little ham radio show, wouldn't it?
Thank you for the opportunity of being here.
Yes, thank you very much for having us over here.
Yes, I'm Tom Rowe, the program director at WGXC, and we've been talking to some ham radio folks, and we'd invite you guys too. On Saturdays, the station does radio, kind of about radio, all day, and we'd love to have a local ham radio show. So if there's people that are interested in producing like a half hour show or segments towards a half hour show, it could be all different groups throughout the area, each producing smaller segments to make up a show or something. But if you all are interested, or you know anybody else that's interested, we are definitely interested in having you guys aboard. And
we could take it to the max and actually do an amateur radio licensing training course using this station as
that
the venue.
Really
nice idea.
Exciting.
Yes, and similarly, any of those radio clubs you're talking about in the high schools, a similar offer is up. They could be involved in the show here too on the station.
That would be a great idea. So maybe this is the beginning, the baby step that you need to do that. So thank you so much. And before I forget, let me go ahead and... Okay, everybody, that was Delaney, and he was asking that I start the animal connections because we've been talking a lot about technology and people, and I just want to take the time there to tell you that there is something I wanted to help out from Born Free, and I would like you to urge your representative to co-sponsor HR 2657. It's Congresswoman Nita Lowey from Dean, New York, has worked with Born Free and their colleagues to reintroduce the Refuge from Cruel Trapping Act, HR 2657, and this important initiative finally would end the horrific practice of trapping on national wildlife refuges. Please ask your congressional representative to co-sponsor the bill. When visiting a national wildlife refuge, most people expect to see wildlife in abundance without fear of stepping into a trap or having to witness the pain and suffering of a trapped animal. More than half of America's refuge lands, however, allow barbaric and indiscriminate trapping. We are horrified that the brutal practice occurs in some of the very last safe havens for wildlife in the United States. So if you could help them, that would be really a great thing for you to do. Now, captive, there's also the Captive Primate Safety Act introduced in the U.S. Senate. The Born Free USA, again, is spearheading an important congressional initiative to protect non-human primates. Today, U.S. Senators Barbara Boxer from California and David Vitter from Louisiana and Richard Blumenthal from Connecticut introduced the Captive Primate Safety Act, S-1324, which prohibits interstate commerce in monkeys, apes, and other primates in the exotic pet trade. Please ask your two U.S. senators to co-sponsor the bill today. The commercial trade in primates involves tremendous suffering and grave dangers to human health and safety. These innocent animals are often confined in small cages and have their teeth or fingernails extracted. We can't allow animals to be mutilated in the name of companionship. Non-human primates also pose disease risks, including transmission of Ebola, tuberculosis, and herpes B. Even though nearly half of the states already prohibit private possession of these wild animals as pets, primates are easily obtained over the internet and throughout the state through out-of-state dealers and auctions, making federal legislation necessary to support the efforts of state law enforcement. So those are two important issues. I would like to tell you that Best Friends Animal Society is going to have a Strut Your Mutt for September 25 in New York City at the Hudson River Park's Pier 84 and September 24 in Los Angeles at Pan Pacific Park. You can go to www.strutyourmutt.org. And let me remind you that there is the free rabies shots in Carroll on August 24th at the Carroll Firehouse on Railroad Avenue. They are provided by Dr. Curtis Halstead of the Maple Ridge Veterinarian Office located in Earlton. And all dogs need to be on a leash and cats need to be in a reliable carrying case, and please call ahead for ferrets. There is no charge for these clinics, although donations will be accepted. And that's August 24th, 6 p.m. to 8 p.m. at the Carroll Firehouse, Railroad Avenue, Carroll. Now, I end with two things. My life is bearable when. So here you go. This week, it's life is bearable when the phone rings and someone says, you've got the job. And fortune cookie wisdom, let there be magic in your smile and firmness in your handshake. Now before I go, instead of ending with what I usually end with, I would like to end with an amateur radio song I found. So here we go.
Radio,
Pittsburgh.
Oh, it's
Oh, isn't that wonderful?
Yeah.
Yeah, there were definitely people listening. Yes. Oops. Oh, what's that back in?
Oh, yeah. That's why I'm running in.